summer is here. And if it's not too darn hot today, you know it's bound to be again soon, sometime, because as the mercury rises, you know, what's the last thing you want to do? See, it's hot. It's hot in the kitchen. You don't want to spend your afternoons next to a hot oven or with four pots boiling on the stove. Maybe you don't even have the space for barbecuing. So what's the solution? Well, for some, it's a lot more salads and sandwiches and maybe ice cream for dinner. But what if you could cook up something tasty without using heat? That was a bit more interesting than maybe using, you know, just having ice cream. There is a trick. There are lots of tricks we're going to talk about on how to cook without the heat, maybe using a bit of lime juice or a lot of salt or other tricks of science. Well, you interested? It's time for a special no heat edition of our food failures series. And if you want to, you want your tricks too, do you have a favorite no heat cooking technique or recipe? We want to hear about it. You can give us a call, 844-724-8255, 844-SciTalk. You can also tweet us at SciFry. I have a tray full of wonderful, cold, delicious-looking food here. Sitting across from me is Jeff Potter, author of Cooking for Geeks, Real Science, Great Hacks, and Good Food. As I say, he's here in our New York studios. Welcome back to Science Friday, Jeff.
Thanks for having me, Ira.
You can cook without heat.
Well, depends on your definition of cook, but if you consider it preparing food, yes. And what I brought you today is probably the strangest lunch of all. Salmon gravlax, some beef jerky, ceviche, and salt-preserved lemons.
Mmm.
Well, it doesn't exactly go all together by itself, but
no.
They're all great examples of things we can do.
A lot of good grazing here. Now, let's talk first about why heat is such a crucial part of cooking in the first place.
Well, there's really two reasons that we cook food in terms of putting heat on it. One is for textural changes and things that make the food more delicious. So think about that steak that's seared and has those nice brown Maillard reaction aromas. But the second reason is around the safety aspects. And heat really turns out to be a fantastic way to kill those pathogens that might make you sick.
Right. Yeah, that's, you know, makes it easier to digest, but you have to kill off the bad.
You got to kill, right.
if we're looking to eat without heat, what do we need to do to make it then safe?
So, yeah, if we're talking about the pathogens and kind of the aspect of safety, pathogens themselves have a couple of different variables that are important for them to be able to thrive and survive. There's this lovely acronym, FAT-TOM, where each letter stands for something that is important for microbial growth. Mm-hmm. I won't rattle through all of them, but the lemon and lime juice is the A, and the fat, which is acidity. So the pH range is really important. And then there's things like oxygen. Obviously, bacteria and microbes have to be able to mm-hmm. go through respiration, or in some cases, anaerobic without it. And there's also things like the M in fat, Tom, actually, moisture.
Ah.
Another really important concept, and that's where our beef jerky comes into play.
All right. We want to hear from you if you'd like to take part in heatless cooking, 844-724-8255. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. Talking with Jeff Potter, author of Cooking for Geeks. Okay, let's talk. Let's start with acidity. Can I dunk my burger in vinegar? You know, to make it safe to eat.
I don't know about dunking a burger in hamburgers are ground meat.
Right.
And the issue there is that essentially it's all outside. So if we're talking about beef, the issue there is any surface contamination that might come up during slaughtering. Mm-hmm. And when you grind it, that surface contamination, well, hamburgers, all ground beef. So yeah. If you're to dunk it in vinegar or lime juice, you're only actually coating the outside at that point. But if you took something that was not ground, where the surface had some contamination, right. And you dipped that into something very acidic, that would take care of surface contamination. And with something like a whole muscle intact steak, the interior is considered generally sterile, so that actually would take care of it. And there are some dishes in some cultures where you take beef and you actually marinate them in something that's very acidic.
Give me an example. You brought something with you that's been cooked with acid.
Well, in this case, the scallops are in lime juice. Mm. So these scallops are previously frozen, which means anything that might be in the interior in terms of parasites would be killed by the freezing process. And then the outside has been soaked in lime juice. In this case, scallops actually take quite a long time to really do much of anything, so a couple hours. Other kinds of fish, saltwater fish, actually can kind of go faster, 30 minutes, maybe an hour. So in this case, it's really about the food item what pathogens might be present on that food item, and then what technique can we use to render those pathogens mostly safe.
So by definition, I'm looking at it, it looks like a raw scallop in terms of it's not being cooked on a flame.
It's not being cooked with heat.
Right.
Now, this goes into the definition.
Should I give it a try?
Yeah, go for it. This gets into the definition of what does cooked mean, and that's more of a linguistic question, less of a science one. In this case, the acids are taking, and that's very acidic. It's just straight up lime juice. I didn't add any cilantro or onions as I might normally.
Delicious.
So in this case, you need about 15% of lime juice or lemon juice or vinegar by weight, kind of to make sure you have a sufficiently acidic environment. But yeah, it's basically taking the proteins on the outside and denaturing them, changing the way they, you know, are structured. And that, of course, would also denature any bacteria that might be on the outside.
And of course, I make pickles at home, but I ferment the pickles. Is that sort of cooking them, fermentation?
Yeah, sure, definitely. In that case, what you're doing is you're introducing a particular, not a pathogen, but a particular bacteria, and letting it go to town. And that particular strain is going to essentially prevent other things from coming in and kind of taking over. It's actually, that's a fascinating question for somebody in the fungal area in terms of the science of that.
Like, that's something that's going on anaerobically because it has to be under the brine there that I have. So it's an anaerobic. There's so many things. I want to get to all the food on the tray here, so I'm not going to start because we have to go to a break. But we're talking with Jeff Potter, author of Cooking for Geeks. If you have a recipe or something you'd like to suggest that you make without using a flame or very low cooking, give us a call. Our number is 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry. We'll be right back after this break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking about ways to cook your food without using heat or a very tiny amount of heat. You know, it's a sweaty midsummer edition of Food Failures where we try to keep the kitchen as livable as we can. If it's not hot where you are now, you will thank us later. Yes. Yeah, summers are getting hotter. My guest is Jeff Potter, author of Cooking for Geeks. And I just finished sampling something that was soaked in lime juice, right, for a while. It was delicious.
Thank you.
And that's very acidic. What about going in the other direction, something very alkaline?
So we don't have too many foods that really use things that are particularly basic. Most foods happen to basically be acidic. The few cases I could really find were things that involved lye. So century eggs use lye to actually pull up the pH to, you know, 9 to 12, that high actually. And then you've got things like, there's this Norwegian fish, I can never say the name, lutefisk?
Lutefisk. Oh, I spent a lot of time in Minnesota.
So
I think it's buried in the ground. It's very actually treated with lye, absolutely. And I've had lutefisk, and let me be kind about it and say you have to, it's an acquired taste.
There are a couple of dishes around the world that are acquired. Iceland is famous for its buried shark. And I would say between eating something like buried shark or lutefisk versus starving, I would probably take, you know, the food even if it's got strange things. Lutefisk was really funny. I was trying to dig into more about what happens to the science. We don't know so much, but one thing I did find was that in the Wisconsin statutes, they specifically define toxic substances and they exclude lutefisk. It's actually in their list.
Wow. Well, let me tell you, we have big audience in Minnesota. We're going to hear today.
I want to know where that comes from. How did that rider get added? It's in the Regulation of Industry, Buildings, and Safety. It's down there. It says lutefisk. Like,
huh? We will. I tell you, we're going to hear it today. And many times, maybe. Let's go to Ryan in Provo, Utah. Hi, Ryan.
Hi.
Hi there. Go ahead.
I wanted to ask Jeff if he's looked into cured egg yolks.
I actually have a cured egg yolk sitting in my fridge right now at home. I forgot to bring in for this.
What is a cured egg yolk for we novices?
So you can take an egg yolk and basically drop it into salt. You know, surround it in salt. Get a cup, put a half inch of salt in the bottom, put the egg yolk in, cover it with another half inch of salt. Let that sit in your fridge for about a week or so. You can let it go 2 weeks. And you'll get something which is cured yolk. The salt's drawing out a lot of the moisture, reducing the available moisture in the egg from a pathological point of view. But it also changes the texture, changes the flavors. I'm told at 2 weeks in, you get something that's kind of vaguely like Parmesan. strangely.
Right, right. Do you have some?
Yeah, we experimented with that at a restaurant where I cook, and he's right on saying it's kind of like a Parmesan where you can shave it over food.
I've had it that way. It's fantastic.
We threw in some aromatics. Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, I've had it that way, and it's fantastic. Now, you're starting to say aromatics. What else are you doing with it? Because I don't know what to do with the egg yolk I've got at home besides, you know, shave it slightly onto salad.
Yeah, that's why I was curious what you had been doing. We threw in some thyme and rosemary, and I had read about it in a book, and I was kind of wanting to learn more because, you know, the chefs I worked with hadn't really done much with it. But it had a really interesting flavor. Just sort of like enriched and concentrated that yolk kind of buttery umami flavor.
Wow.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Jeff, taking notes here. So,
third edition, right?
good luck, Ryan. Thanks for sharing that hint for us. I never heard of that.
It's really cool, actually. There's something about the concentration process that changes the flavors, not just concentrates them, but it actually, from what I understand, does something to allow additional new flavor compounds to come about.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's go back to my tray here because I want to get to some of these tasty-looking things. There's beef jerky there. What does that symbolize?
Well, that's when I said Fat Tom earlier, that's the M in moisture. And with beef jerky, what we're doing is removing as much moisture as possible to get what's called the water activity, which is a measure of the amount of available moisture, to get that water activity down low enough. And it's basically a way of preserving. If there's not water available for microbes to grow, well, then they don't grow.
I grossed out a lot of people last week chewing, so I'm not going to do that again.
So there's two pieces there.
No, I just had a piece. I turned the mic off. It was really good. It's salty.
Yeah.
Right? Is that part of the dehydration process?
Well, salt helps the proteins in the meat tissue bond to more of the water. So when I talk about moisture and water activity, it's really about how much water is available. And the salt there is allowing the proteins to hold onto more of the moisture, making it not available. So it is related. It's not necessarily a specific salinity that's required, but it helps.
It's good. And is dehydrating a common way of storing food or preparing it if you're not heating it?
Well, it depends on what you think of in terms of foods that are dehydrated. Are spices dehydrated? They certainly are. And almost anybody who's a regular cook has got something at home in their cupboard that's dehydrated in that sense. Depends on where you are in the world and culture as well.
Well, we have on our website at sciencefriday.com/jerky. We have more tips and tricks on the beef jerky from Cooking for Geeks on our website, sciencefriday.com/jerky. Lots of people calling in with other kinds of advice, other tips. Let's see if we can get one. Charles in New Haven. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hey, how are you doing today?
Hey there. Go ahead.
So I have a bit of a funny story, and then it turns into a better recipe from there.
Go for it.
The funny story is back in undergrad, my background's as a chemist, a chemistry major. We used to have what we called lab sprouts, which is a terrible idea, but was always fun at parties. And what lab sprouts was is we'd take a Ziploc bag, gallon Ziploc bag, we'd drop, you know, all the fixings you have for Brussels sprouts, you know, the sprouts themselves and whatever you wanted to them, and then we'd leave them soaking for a long time in lab-grade acetic acid. And for those of you that aren't quite familiar with what acetic acid is, all your vinegar is 5% acetic acid by weight. So it's a concentrated, basically, form of vinegar, and we just sort of let it stew in that for a long, long time.
How long is long?
Yeah,
is that a week? Is that a year?
Ira and I are looking at each other here going, okay, what's long?
I think we once had a three-monther where we let it sit for a while.
Now, okay, I'm now curious. What does this do to the Brussels sprouts? Because that seems intense. And we're talking like glacial acetic acid?
Yep, 100%.
Oh, no, not 100%. That's 100%. Yeah. That's... Wow.
Not 100%, but yeah.
Really close. You can't actually quite get to 100.
No.
And so what does it taste like when you take it out after 3 months? What does it taste like?
Sour is the wrong word for it, but it is the chemical equivalent of a sour punch in the face.
So it was more sour than sour.
Yes, exactly. It's like if you got sour down to just what the chemical equivalent of it was, that's what it tastes like.
I'm going to go on record here and suggest this does not sound like a good practice for other listeners to try.
Don't try this at home.
You had mentioned you had a recipe or something that came out of this.
Yeah, so I don't know if you guys are at all familiar with what a switchel is. A switchel is a process where you take a sugary syrup and you take a vinegar. Frequently, it's apple cider syrup and apple cider vinegar, and you make it a very concentrated vinegar. So it is high in that acetic acid. And you basically mix it together and let it sit for a while until it becomes this incredibly potent, like, construct. And then once you have that, you can do a lot of stuff with it. You can dilute it to make, you know, a base for drinks. You can turn it into an oil and vinegar sort of salad dressing, or you can stew vegetables in it. You can you can add just a little bit of heat, or you can just add herbs, spices, salt, and you can let the sort of flavor soak into it. And it's a much less a novelty, you know, party trick than lab sprouts were.
I'll have to look that up. It makes me think of shrubs and drinks. Concentrated. Yeah.
Well, you see, you've put your chemistry background to good use, making good food. So, thank you for sharing that with us. Have a good weekend. Yeah, so there's this interesting stuff going on.
It never ceases to amaze me the things that people are willing to guinea pig on themselves when it comes to things they'll cook in their kitchen and try.
Now, you asked for what can we do with the eggs. Remember, we were doing, what else can I do with the eggs, you ask?
Yeah.
You ask our listeners. They respond. Let's go
Thank
to Pittsburgh.
You, listeners.
Dawn in Pittsburgh, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Hi there. Go ahead.
So I'm Chinese. Cured eggs is like a very traditional thing. We typically use duck eggs. That's even better than chicken eggs. The way that you described is actually is an accelerated way to cure it, which is great. So what we use it, I'm going to give three examples. One would be fried rice. So you just kind of sprinkle it when you do fried rice. That'll, you know, add a little bit of a like salty umami flavor. And another thing we use is to, when you steam white fish, so you would use some of that to kind of get the flavor, you know, out better. Another thing that I would use is grilled vegetables. So let's say you grow zucchini, eggplant, and then, because I guess we don't typically grill, but I can see grill would translate well. Using some of that on top of the grilled vegetables.
So a question for you. When you're talking about cured eggs, you're referring to century eggs?
No, not that.
Okay. Okay, so you're talking about cured eggs as cured in salt as opposed to the live-based process.
Salt, yeah.
Okay.
Exactly. Not that we call it, I know, thousand-year-old eggs, cured, dark, not that.
The danger of talking about food is it makes me really hungry. So now I'm going to go home. I actually have
I'm going to give you some of this.
I've got some rice at home in my fridge that I actually fried up for lunch today. And I should have thought. Now I've got the ingredients for this in my fridge, so these tips.
I got to give him some food here. I got to feed him. So thanks for calling.
Okay.
I have Gravlax here, and why is Gravlax representative? Except that it's cold salmon, right?
It's cold salmon that's been pressed in. It's got a salt cure on it, so it's actually similar. I'll warn you, mine's a little salty, so I'm glad you got a cup of water there. So it's actually very similar in the process of jerky in the sense that it's removing moisture. So in the case of beef jerky, when you put it into a dehydrator, you're mechanically removing it, letting it sublimate out. In the case of salt, you're removing available moisture by adding in salt that absorbs water, preventing it from being accessible to other microbes. In the case of Gravlax, you know, historically, you could imagine being in a fishing village where you caught some fish and you want to go a couple of days inland. It's not going to last as long as the beef jerky. Well, none of this lasts very long because I eat it too fast. But in case of the Gravlax, it's not going to last for days and days. You know, it's something you can make, put in your fridge, use it within a week. The beef jerky with proper heat processing on it can actually last years.
I mean, years.
Theoretically. Yeah. The food safety people don't say years, but there's nothing that should be problematic there.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. Talking with author, cook, and great food expert Jeff Potter, author of Cooking for Geeks. Now my salivary glands are working over time. That really was salty, but it was delicious.
Yeah. A little bit of dill. I put a little vodka in there. It helps. It's a solvent.
I see. Of course. It's medicinal. Let's say you just want to stick with the old-fashioned salad. I want to stick with a salad. Can you help us make a perfect dressing for that?
Oh, Lordy, I think a perfect dressing depends upon what you like in in your salad.
Just a little bit of balsamic vinegar will do it for
me. I personally, this is a very, maybe it's a good food answer, not a very interesting science answer. Personally, I just do a little bit of olive oil, some oregano, and some dried oregano. It's actually really good.
Well, let's talk about things that people eat that are raw, and then why are they safe? For example, why is beef tartare safe to eat, or even sushi? Why is that safe to eat?
So this goes back to, what's the food product? What are the sources of safety issues around them, whether they be endemic in wherever the food's from, or introduced in post-harvest, and then how it's handled. In the case of something like sushi or beef tartare, the things that we typically use for those dishes are animals that don't have particular issues. So there's a reason why we don't typically see things like, I don't know, cod sushi. Not that it can't be done, but if you look at most species of, many species of tuna, for example, don't generally have parasites, and they don't have things like E. coli or salmonella. If you look at something like beef tartare, you can have surface contamination. So if I was going to try to make somebody a really nice steak tartare, I would actually, and I was, you know, wanting to be a little more careful than normal, recognizing that there's always some risk in, in these sorts of things. I would actually dip it in very hot water, not quite boiling, you know, call it 180, 185 degrees for 10, 20 seconds. And what that's going to do is reduce most of the surface contamination that might exist in terms of E. coli down to a level that's unlikely to cause problems. Mm-hmm. And then the interior of that muscle in the case of steak is considered generally sterile. So it's kind of a, what's the food product? What's the technique you're using? How do you match the right processes up so that it's safe?
Let's say that you really have to cook something, you know, because you just don't like to eat raw stuff or whatever, and you want to keep the kitchen as cool as possible. What's the best way to cook? You want to cook something. I mean, is there a pot you should use or any sort of thing?
I would actually tackle it by thinking about traditions of different cultures. This is probably more of an anthropological answer, but if you look at cultures that are closer towards the equator, where cooking with a lot of heat is not something that they're going to want to do. So actually things like stir fries as opposed to roasts. You know,
Or a pressure cooker, right?
Or a pressure cooker.
It stays in.
So if we want to bring the science in, the pressure cooker part is actually really fun because increasing pressure increases the rate of reactions. So if you take something, let's say you did want to make that roast I mentioned a minute ago in the middle of summer, but you don't want your oven on for 6 or 8 hours or whatever. If you do it in a pressure cooker where your temperature can get up to about 240 degrees, and that's based on increased pressure, so you can have increased boiling point, so the rest of the muscle tissue can get hotter in that environment, things like the breakdown of collagen will occur much, much faster. So what might normally take 6 hours, you know, might take an hour or two or half an hour, depends on the exact details of the food. So
that's good. That's a good solution.
Yeah, it's definitely the modern thing.
Yeah, yeah. And then if you want to know more great tips from Jeff, he's got a book out called Cooking for Geeks, Real Science, Great Hacks, Good Food. Jeff Potter, always great to have you.
Thank you.
Here with us and bringing me my dinner tonight, because I'm sure that's what it's going to be. And if you want to tackle dessert, did you know that chocolate is a crystal? Today is actually the International Chocolate Lovers Day. And chocolate is a crystal. You can test it out in your very own kitchen, courtesy of the Science Friday Educate team. Head over to sciencefriday.com/chocolate to try it. Bon appetit. To me, every day is chocolate day.